This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Gillian Tett tried to warn people 2 years before the 2008 financial crisis that it was coming. Few listened to her. Some told her to stop being so negative. She was right to be negative and later blamed other people's lack of awareness on their being in their own little silos. Later, she would write a book about the silo effect, which examines modern corporate structure and helps explain how departmentalizing so much knowledge can lead smart people to make very bad decisions. Gillian Tett is U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times, so she knows a lot about how organizations work, and rather than siloing that information, writes about it regularly in the pages of the Times and in her books. We're going to talk about how to break down silos, among other things, this hour. Gillian Tett is in town under the auspices of the World Affairs Council, and she joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Mike.
And by the way, she's speaking at noon at the Hilton Charlotte Center City, and there are still seats available for that. You can get information at worldaffairscouncilcharlotte.org. We're going to talk about a lot of different things this hour, but let's go back to 2007, before the financial crisis. How is it that you saw it coming?
Well, I think that insofar as I saw anything coming, it's down to not my training as a financial journalist or training in economics. It's because I was actually trained in cultural anthropology, social anthropology, before I became a journalist. And what you do as an anthropologist is learn to look at societies and the way we think and live and imagine our lives as a whole. Anthropologists try and look at the world bottom up. They try and look at not just what people are talking about, but what they're not talking about. Because anthropologists believe that the way that systems reproduce themselves and the elite stay in power is because there's so many parts of our lives that go unchallenged. And so I essentially use the same skills I'd use as an anthropologist in my place, in my case, a place called Tajikistan, was where I did my field work. I use that to look at the banking world. And
Tajikistan?
Exactly. I went from Tajikistan. If any of your listeners can point to Tajikistan on a map or spell it, they deserve a prize. But I went from looking at a little village in the high mountains of the Himalayas in Tajikistan to analyzing how bankers behave. And you know what? At the end of the day, we're all human.
Wow. So what was it about how they were behaving then that sent up red flags for you?
Well, here's the issue. What you had was a bunch of very well-paid bankers who thought they had stumbled on the holy grail that was going to transform the world. It's an awful lot like Silicon Valley today. They had created this new technology called securitization, all these derivatives, all these complex words, which nobody else outside their little world actually understood. It was as if they were in charge of some magic powers that they believed were going to make the financial system better than ever before. And this new technology was also making many of them very rich. And so what you had was a bunch of bright people taking quite an intelligent idea to crazy, crazy, crazy extremes.
And these are the famous credit default swaps.
These were what was going on was you had bankers who were taking mortgages and other kinds of loans and slicing and dicing them and repackaging them into new securities and selling them all over the place. It was a bit like making financial sausages, where you take meat from all over the place, slice and dice it, and sell it in new casings. In this case, they were called things like CDOs or derivatives to other people. And in theory, it was a great idea because they were spreading risk all over the place, a bit like making sausages is a great idea. The problem was, in this case, they were so sloppy in their sausage making that there was some bad meat getting into the food chain, in this case, bad loans. And later on, people couldn't tell where the bad meat had gone. And so there was a panic. And the real issue is this, that when you look back at what happened in 2006 in retrospect, you say, well, how were people so crazy? You know, what were they doing? What were they thinking? And it's very easy to say, well, those bankers were either evil or stupid or greedy or all three at once. The reality is, though, that they were just being human. They'd stumbled on something that did very well for them, and they had no incentive to question their world because they were in such a bubble.
Did you know, when you took a look at this world and these people, did you know that the instruments that they were cobbling together were rotten on the inside in some way? Or did that actually surprise you over time?
When I first started looking at this world, I didn't know that the instruments themselves were rotten. But what I could see was a situation where you had, if you liked, a financial priesthood who were in charge of this technology that no one else understood, and where there was no checks and balances to stop them going mad. Ordinary people had no idea what was going on. And it wasn't a case of the bankers necessarily concocting a plot to go out there and fool the public. It was more that they were doing rather well by the system and had no reason to challenge it. And there's a great line from the American novelist Upton Sinclair, which says, "It's very hard to get a man to understand if his job depends on not understanding." I.e., no one had an incentive to challenge the tunnel vision, the bubble mentality that had developed.
So when did you first think, this is going to go bust, and we need to tell people about this? And you started to tell people about this, and they told you to stop being so negative. When did this happen?
The very first time it happened was when I went to a banking conference in about 2005 or 6, and I walked into a typical conference of bankers, and I thought, wow, this is just like a Tajik wedding, because what you have is a set of rituals which are designed to create this lovely in-group feeling amongst a little tribe of people who speak a language that no one else understands. And I sat there and I listened to the presentations of all these newfangled instruments that people were creating, including people like Bank of America or Wells Fargo. And I suddenly thought, they've sat here and they've talked about finance for several hours. They've had their equations. They've had all their fancy Greek letters. They've never once mentioned a human being anywhere in this lending game. Somewhere, something is going very badly wrong here.
Why? Why does the human being have to be part of this? And when you say human being, are you talking about the people on the other end of the loan, the people who actually have the mortgage?
The problem was that they were forgetting that the whole finance business was part of a chain, mm-hmm. that at the end of the day connected back to real people who were actually taking out loans and living real lives. And many of the bankers were so detached from the reality of what their loans were doing that they were just looking at lending and credit as simply being a set of numbers, if you like, or an equation. They were forgetting the question of whether or not people could actually repay their loans or not really mattered.
Sure. Gillian Tett is the U.S. managing editor for the Financial Times. You're not the only financial journalist in the world, and you had colleagues at the Financial Times and Wall Street Journal and other places, The Economist. Why did they miss this? Is it strictly because they don't have an anthropologist's viewpoint on these things?
I think it's for two reasons. Firstly, there was a very strong dominant idea in the economics world, which basically said that so long as inflation's low, mm-hmm. so long as the economy's growing, everything's fine. So there was always a cultish worship of macroeconomics and economic theory. But I think the other reason is much simpler, that economists and bankers and policymakers had forgotten that they need to get it out and actually wear out the shoe leather and go to real people, real communities, and see what's happening on the ground. And it's all part of whether or not we're living in a connected society. Are we living in a world where the people who have the power and make loans actually get out and see on the ground what's happening in real people's lives? Or are they so semi-detached and in a bubble they have no idea?
But why does that matter? I mean, if you go in to apply for a loan and you bring all your financial information and it all looks good and it all adds up and the numbers work out, why does it matter?
Well, here's a tiny example. The Federal Reserve had traditionally assumed that when people defaulted, they would default first on their credit card, then on a car loan, and then on their houses. Mm-hmm. And that had been the traditional model that had worked for decades. And at the beginning of the last decade, that pattern changed quite significantly, because today in America, everyone knows that if you're going to survive, you need a credit card first, then you need a car. You can't get a job often without that, and you can always sleep in your car. And then last but not least, a home is, you know, became, I wouldn't say optional, but it became something people traded. So at a human level, in terms of the cultural patterns, the kind of thing that anthropologists actually study, mm-hmm. that pattern changed dramatically. Anyone living on the ground would have seen that mm-hmm. as an anthropologist. But if you're in your ivory tower as an economist, you just look at your financial models and you don't see how things have changed.
And homes have become piggy banks.
Absolutely. And the key point is this, that if you don't actually go out and talk to real people and observe how they live, mm-hmm. do the 101 of anthropology, and actually try to look at life in a holistic fashion, you don't just miss seeing what's really going on, but also policymakers and business leaders can make some terrible mistakes.
So it all came crashing down, probably worse than you anticipated, because it led to this worldwide recession. And the U.S. and other countries took very different approaches to getting themselves out of this. The U.S. became kind of the government stepped in. They saved General Motors and Chrysler and other industries, and they pumped money into the economy. European governments took a different take on this. They more of an austerity approach. Obviously, I think it could be said that the American approach turned out to be better. Would you agree with that or not?
Well, certainly today the American banks are a lot healthier than the European banks. And actually, I'd say what the Europeans did was follow the pattern of Japan in the 1990s. I actually lived in Japan in the 1990s, and my first book was about the Japanese financial crisis. And what the Japanese did was they swept the problems under the carpet for as long as they possibly could. And they tried to essentially deny the scale of the problems. They kept hoping that they would go away or that property prices would rise again and suddenly everything would be fine. Americans, after trying to do that for about a year, then recognized that they had to face up to the scale of the financial crisis and deal with it. And so I think for that reason, the American banking system today is a lot healthier.
Why didn't other economies see that pumping money into the system would help all boats rise or perhaps cause some boats not to sink irrevocably into the deep blue sea? I mean, why didn't they see that at the time?
Well, I think that in Europe, when the crisis broke, there was initially an assumption it was an American problem. It was very much a made-in-America financial crisis. So there wasn't such an immediate sense of we must own up to the mistakes we've made. In fact, European banks did as many stupid things as American banks, sadly. But secondly, there was a very strong sense in Europe that governments wanted to protect jobs, they wanted to protect people, they wanted to prop the system up. And tragically, I would argue that that's meant that a lot of the problems are still in the system today. When I was living in Japan, the Japanese used to have a lovely phrase when the Japanese banks tried to sweep the problems under the carpet, which is, you can put rotten meat in a freezer and it stops smelling, but it's still rotten. Mm. And that's true of bad loans. It's true of bad assets in the banks. Unfortunately, you can pretend they don't exist, but they don't just magically disappear.
So you began to write about, you wrote an article first, I believe, and then you wrote a book about silos. Did that come out of this experience with the financial meltdown? Is part of the reason for the meltdown is that very bright people who ran the banks, either because they didn't want to get out of their silos because they were afraid of what they might have found, or simply because they were in these silos, they weren't seeing other pieces of information that could have led to them to realize what they were doing was in bad, bad shape.
Well, absolutely. In 2008, I wrote a book first about J.P. Morgan and about the credit derivatives products that a group of bankers there had created. And I tried to explain how a little tribe, a tiny team of bankers, has stumbled on what seemed to be like a really good idea, which had turned out to be horribly, horribly dangerous when it was copied in a stupid way across the financial system. And after that book was published, I kept thinking, well, this story about a little team of people trying to do something which then goes horribly wrong is not just about finance. You've seen the same pattern all over the business world and all over government today.
And we'll talk about that when we come back with Julian Tett, the U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times and the author of The Silo Effect, Ordered Chaos, The Peril of Expertise, and the Power of Breaking Down Barriers. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and All About Beer magazine, presenting Beer Quest Saturday, November 19th at the BB&T Ballpark, where participants can sample a variety of beers. Tickets at beerquestfest.com or at the ballpark box office. And Hendrick Automall, Concord Mills, committed to customer service, satisfaction, and excellence in the car buying experience. Featuring for summer over 3,000 vehicles and 11 brands. Details at HendrickAutomallConcordMills.com. Election year and talk of politics is everywhere. It's in the air. It's on the air. It's in church. According to the Pew Research Center, almost two-thirds of Americans have heard their preacher talk about political issues and even candidates. And when they do that, they walk a fine legal line. So what are the implications of politics in the pulpit? How has that conversation changed? What's being said this election year? We look at all of that and more tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a federal judge orders a review of nearly 15,000 recently discovered Hillary Clinton emails. A new batch related to the Clinton Foundation was also released. The ongoing controversy over Clinton's emails.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jillian Tett is our guest, the U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times. She's in town today because she's speaking at the World Affairs Council Charlotte Luncheon at the Hilton Charlotte Center City, and you can still go there if you'd like by going to their website, worldaffairscouncilcharlotte.org, and registering. Comedian Bill Maher talks about the bubble that conservatives find themselves in from time to time, and I'm sure the same could be said of liberals. They live in their own little bubble, and they don't want to see what's outside that bubble. Is that the same thing as silos?
Absolutely. I mean, I use the word silo because it's short and it translates into most languages, except for Japanese, where it's translated as octopus pot. It's a true story. All the Japanese listeners in Charlotte will know this, but you know, I use the word silo. You can equally well talk about bubbles. You can talk about stovepipes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what word you use. The key point is this. We live on a planet where we have the illusion that we're hyper-connected because of cell phones, because of the internet, because of supply chains, because of airplanes. And in some ways, the planet is more connected than ever before because shocks can travel very quickly across the system. Mm-hmm. But if you look around the way that people live and think and act and organize themselves, we're actually incredibly fragmented still. We have a lot of tribalism, a lot of polarization, a lot of tunnel vision where other bright people do stupid things because they just can't think outside the box.
Is that because in this Twitterverse in which we live, where people are getting constant information, they're getting it from sources that reflect who they are? In other words, you are only going to follow on Twitter people that you trust, people like you who may have the same outlook as you. So you're not getting the full picture. Is that why?
I think that absolutely. I think internet and technology is very dangerous because it gives us the illusion we're connected to everything. And yet a world where we get to choose exactly what we want. We live in Generation C, Generation Customization, where we can customize our coffee, our T-shirts, our music lists, and our media sources. And people invariably start customizing things that are going to reflect their own worldview.
And maybe people outside this business don't understand this, but I know that when there were three channels and just a few radio stations on the air in every city, and there was only the BBC in London, those organizations tried to be as broad as they possibly could to bring in different points of view. And in this country, we had the Fairness Doctrine that has disappeared, in which different points of view had by law to be on the air. Well, you don't have to do that anymore. And everything is highly specialized. It's very niche. And so if you pick a niche to listen to or watch, that's where you are. You're in that silo.
Absolutely. And in fact, I first started thinking about Generation C, Generation Customization, through my own daughters, who loved going to Starbucks. And they assumed that they had the right to customize their own drink. And I was thinking, you know what, when I was growing up, I never assumed I could customize my coffee or my lunch menu. You know, we bought albums of records that were chosen already. We couldn't customize our playlist. And this trend towards customization is really important because everyone assumes that consumers have a God-given right to basically choose and model the world as they want. And in some ways, it's very liberating. But it also is a recipe for tribalism. And Dick Costolo, the former CEO of Twitter, told me a couple of years ago that he made a point every few weeks of changing who he followed on Twitter completely.
Wow.
And trying to get somebody who had a completely alternative point of view, lived in another part of the world, did something else. Because it's not unless you actually try for a week or two to knock out everyone you follow on Twitter and put a different group there, or change who you follow on Facebook, you realize how subtly we're being sucked into these new forms of tribalism and new forms of fragmentation, even as we think that the internet connects us.
But aren't we built that way? There was a report on NPR this morning about how Donald Trump's followers and conservative followers tend to be in rural areas because conservatives like space. And liberals tend to be clustered in cities where they're very close together because they like to be in the mix with other people. That's who we are, whether you're conservative or liberal. So even if you change your Twitter feed to follow the opposite point of view, are you really going to buy into it? Are you really going to stick with it?
It is a fundamental human trait, as anthropologists know, that we like to cluster with people like us. We like to organize our worldview into nice little tidy mental boxes or silos. We prefer to have a system where everything's classified. So tribalism is inevitable, and, you know, frankly, it's not always bad. The problem today, though, is really twofold. Firstly, because we have the internet, we don't actually see the ways we're becoming tribal today. In some senses, it's very seductive, this technology. It makes us very blind. But secondly, we live in an era when shocks can be transmitted across the globe very quickly as a result of what one group does. And we also live in a world that's very interconnected, and where small groups of people can be in control of technology that can, frankly, blow up the world, affect us all. Just look what happened in the 2008 financial crisis. So the costs of our different social tribes not understanding each other, I would argue, are getting bigger and bigger by the day.
I guess I should ask you at this point, how do you fix that? How do you make people get out of these tribal associations? I'm not sure you have an answer for that, though, do you?
I think there are a number of things that one can do to ameliorate the tribalism. Education is one part of the equation. Encouraging kids from the youngest possible age to keep their minds open, to not just settle into one little cozy niche, to tell kids if they're going to be on social media to try and get out of their tribe from time to time.
But that's hard for parents to do, because sometimes parents want their kids to believe what they believe, to be in the same pocket that they find themselves in, whether it's religious or whether it's political or some other, I don't know what the word is. That's what they want. They don't want their kids to have an open mind necessarily.
Of course, everybody wants their kids to be exactly like them usually. But the reality is that if we live in a world of total tribalism and tunnel vision, yeah, it's a very, very dangerous world. And one of the roles of education is to try and expand people's minds and try and make them aware of new ideas. Everybody can try and do things in their own life to become more broad-minded and at least be aware of what lies outside their own little tunnel or tribe.
And if this appears scary to some people, because it is scary when you break out of your religious belief system or you're out of your political belief system, let's bring it to business, because business is kind of common to everybody, and almost everybody has a job. And this is where silos really get people into trouble, according to you, because most organizations organize themselves into departments. So you have the accounting department, and you have the sales department, and you have the whatever department. And they don't necessarily speak to each other.
Absolutely. I mean, it's anyone who's worked for a big company will know the problem of silos is very, very pervasive. It's not just about finance. It's right across the business world. And the problem with silos is they make bright people do stupid things. We saw that in the 2008 financial crisis, where so many of the problems that emerged in the banking world occurred because people were essentially overwhelmed by tunnel vision, and one department didn't talk to another. They simply couldn't join up the dots about what was happening. So silos make people blind to risks. You see the same pattern, say, at General Motors with the seatbelt scandal there. You see it in many big big government bureaucracies. You know, you want to know why the CIA missed the problems leading up to the 9/11 attacks. A large part was because you had stovepiping, as they say in the military.
The FBI didn't talk to the CIA, and they didn't talk to the
exactly.
NSA. But in a situation where you have these silos, you have all these people in those silos who have extreme expertise, one would believe, in the silo in which they're living and working. They know a lot about that. So when you open that silo up and you bring in the sales department or you bring in the accounting department, don't they get in the way? I mean, they don't know what you know, and you don't care what they know, because it doesn't deal with what you're dealing with to try to produce the results that you're mandated to get. So doesn't that just get in the way and slow things down?
Breaking down silos can certainly seem inefficient in the short term and time-consuming. It costs money. But in the medium to long term, the cost of not breaking down silos is huge. And if you do learn to break down silos, that often makes companies more innovative and creative. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a small example of this. If you've ever had a Sony Walkman, and I bet a lot of your listeners grew up glued to your Sony Walkman, you should ask yourself why you don't have a Sony Walkman today. And the reason is that at the turn of the century, Sony had had an amazing success with a Walkman, good old-fashioned bit of hardware. But it had such a rigid worldview where it kept its hardware separate from software, separate from content, i.e. music, that it was completely unable to actually mix and match those different categories and move on, if you like. It was trapped in the past. Whereas a company like Apple, which actually was breaking down silos very aggressively, took those different departments and mixed them together and created the iPod.
But Apple had a lot less to lose because Apple was a computer hardware and somewhat of a software company. Sony, as you mentioned, made the Walkman. They made television sets. They owned Columbia Records. So the record division had a lot to protect. If they opened themselves up to digital and got involved with the Sony Walkman iPad, or iPod rather, they had a lot to lose.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most dangerous things for companies is when they become successful. And success doesn't just breed a sense of complacency. You create these bureaucratic little tribes where people have an incentive to defend the tribal system at all costs. You know, if your department has brought out a hit product, you want to make darn sure you're going to protect the boundaries of your little department and the power base of your department. You don't want to start ripping it apart to try and be creative and think about the next new thing. And the key problem is this, that government bureaucracies and companies create departmental structures that were set up to cope with the world that existed 10 years ago. And the question is, how do you move forward? Mm. In the car industry today, they have exactly the same problem as Sony in the year 2000, because essentially you have the worlds of hardware, i.e. metal bashing to create cars, the world of software, or those clever gizmos that actually tell you where you're driving, and the wider world of, say, urban transport planning. They're all colliding and collapsing into each other. And the problem is that car companies will have a hardware department, a metal bashing department, stick an IT department on in addition, but they're separate, just like Sony had software, hardware, and music in separate divisions. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens next, because the way we live our lives, and it's interesting that car companies are increasingly hiring anthropologists to look at this, the way real consumers live their lives is that hardware, software, content all collapse together. And increasingly, we're living in a world where transport planning is part of the whole equation.
Sony is one of the companies you profile in your book, The Silo Effect. You profile eight companies, among them Facebook, which does break down silos. They deliberately break down silos. How disruptive is that for them? And given that Facebook doesn't have the complexity, I don't think, in terms of the different kinds of businesses that Sony has and some of the other companies that you profile, aren't they at an advantage? Because they're just Facebook.
I mean, well, what I try into my book is every negative example of a company blowing itself up, I try to pick another company which has not blown itself up and done something different. And so the counterpoint to Sony, which was so rigid with its silos or its octopus pots, as they say in Japanese, is Facebook, which has tried very hard to break down silos with great effect. And there's a lot of lessons about what to do if you look at the Facebook story. You know, companies need to create fluid boundaries to their departments, move people around, find ways for employees to interact with each other, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not trying to say that any one company's got the secret sauce, which is always going to work. But the first big step to overcoming silos and tribalism and tunnel vision is to start by recognizing that it exists, often in subtle ways we don't even notice. Yeah. And management consultants like to say, well, you need to think outside the box. I would say you need to start by realizing we're all trapped by mental boxes we inherit from our surroundings and don't notice, or at least don't notice until it's too late.
You talked about how the transportation system is all collapsing into itself. Isn't that a part and parcel of what's going on because of digital technology? Isn't digital technology going to change the world in ways that most of us cannot even fathom? I often thought when I watched Star Trek, what do they do for money? Well, they don't have to have money. And We had a Marshall Brain on this program a couple of years ago. He's a professor at NC State University, who says that in 20 years there aren't going to be any jobs because computers and robots will do them all. We won't have any jobs, and we won't have any money because we don't need money. We won't need money.
Well, we are seeing the most astonishing transformation right now, which people, as you say, have barely begun to even recognize the implications. You know, to take one small example, the shift towards the Uberization of the economy, where you have people increasingly not working full-time 9-to-5 jobs in a kind of corporate bureaucracy with a career ladder, but doing the what I call the equivalent of digital sharecropping, working on demand when they can get a job, which on the one hand is wildly liberating. You know, Uber tries to tell people that if you start doing Uber, you can have a lot of freedom and work on your own schedule. But it's also terrifying because you don't have the same level of job security and you don't have the same level of worker power. And to my mind, what's really interesting right now is not just the scale of the transformation that's happening today in America, the fact that, you know, under some measure you've got 53 million people as part of this new so-called freelancing economy, but the fact that if you look at the presidential race right now, none of the candidates are talking about this stuff, the really important stuff that matters, which is, what are we going to do in a world where digital technology is turning our lives upside down?
But in fact, isn't that at least a part of what makes Donald Trump so appealing, what made Bernie Sanders so appealing, and what happened in Britain with Brexit? This populism, this move toward populism, it's partly because our world is being disrupted, and a part of that disruption is digital, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, what you're seeing is a world where a lot of middle-class jobs are hollowing out. People blame that on China or Mexico. In fact, a lot of it's down to digitization. There's a study out at the moment from Oxford University suggesting that almost half of the American jobs could be replaced by machines in the next 2 to 3 decades. So whatever you think about Mexico, the real challenge right now is not from a Mexican worker, it's from a robot.
Do the candidates who are not talking about this, do they know that?
Well, there are some candidates who are trying to look at this issue right now. I mean, or not candidates, but there are some people in Washington. And interestingly enough, there are some bipartisan groups now merging with people like Senator Warner and other groups like that who are trying to start a dialogue around these issues and saying, how do you create a safety net for workers in a world of Uberization, digital sharecropping? What are we going to do in the future about trying to find jobs for people who are being chucked out of the workforce? But that debate is still very much had on the margins. And it's quite striking that whenever the candidates want to give speeches about jobs and the economy, they tend to go to factories which make visible things that you can touch and feel and see. And that's important. But the reality is that today America's economy is driven less by car plants and things like that and more by services. And trying to get people's head around what they can't see, the service culture, is very important but very hard.
Gillian Tett is our guest. She's the U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times, author of The Silo Effect, author of Saving the Sun, How Wall Street Mavericks Shook Up Japan's Financial World and Made Billions. And we're going to come back and talk about populism and Brexit and the American presidential race. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting the Gypsy Kings, performing flamenco, rumba, salsa, and pop music, along with Spanish vocals, September 7th at Belk Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. And Waldron Law Firm, focused on citizenship, naturalization, and immigration law, as well as LGBT legal issues. 704-444-0057 or waldronlawfirm.com. A federal judge orders a review of nearly 15,000 recently discovered Hillary Clinton emails from her time as Secretary of State. A new batch related to the Clinton Foundation was also just released. And you can talk more about that or hear more about that in a discussion with the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our discussion, you can email us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov repeated this week that Russia doesn't interfere in the affairs of other countries.
It's your community. we help you understand it.
Of course, Charlotte Pride is a celebration for the LGBTQ community, but it's also a celebration for Charlotte.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jillian Tett is our guest, U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times here, thanks to the World Affairs Council Charlotte. Her book is called, or I guess it's her latest book, although you're writing one now, I believe, or you...
It's my third book, yes.
The Silo Effect is the latest one, about silos and breaking them down and sharing information across platforms, whether you're in industry or in other parts of your life. Britain just made a very important and, to many people, a surprising decision. It even surprised a lot of the people who voted for leaving the European Union. For some reason, I don't know why it surprised them that if they voted for it, they might actually leave the Union. Would that decision have been made had people understood more the financial system and the good parts of the European Union? I'm sure they're bad parts. But would that same vote have taken place in the way it turned out?
Well, I think the way to understand what happened with the Brexit vote, which came as a huge shock to certainly the international business community, much of the elite media, political groups and things like that, was the vote really showed the level of political polarization and tribalism that's been developing in recent years, and polarization. And what you have was a lot of people inside the UK who are pretty angry with the system, fed up with the elites, fed up with the establishment, didn't have any trust in what the establishment was telling them, didn't want to be lectured to or patronized with lots of statistics and lots of scare stories.
And you say that the other side, the people who wanted to stay in the Union, did not do an effective job of communicating to those who wanted to leave why they should stay.
The people who wanted to stay in the European Union did not explain how important it was in terms of the economic impact in language that people could understand. And they didn't understand the level of frustration that ordinary people felt with everything.
Why are they frustrated? Why don't they trust the so-called elites? And when did elite become a bad word?
Well, I think elite became a very bad word really after 2007 and 8, after the financial crisis. And I think the breakdown in trust, and it's partly a function of real economics, rising economic inequality. It's partly a function of dashed hopes, a feeling that actually living standards are not increasing for the majority of people. It's also a function of technology. And we live in an era where people are more likely to trust their Facebook friends for information than they are to trust anybody in authority.
I don't know very much about English history, or even contemporary English history post-World War II, but I do know that the economy and many of the structures in London were bombed out by the Blitzkrieg during World War II, and it took a long time, as you would imagine, for Europe and for Britain to come back from that. Do people have such short-term memories that they don't remember what things were like back then versus how they are today, for which there is no comparison, one would think? That in fact great progress has been made, has great progress been made and now we're backsliding? What's happening over there?
Well, the real tragedy is the European Union was really created to try and avoid another war.
Right.
And it was driven by a sense of mission to create peace for Europe. And the problem today is that it's turned into, the European Union has gone from this very noble ideal, and it's turned itself into a sort of bureaucratic behemoth and a monster, if you like, that many ordinary voters feel has no democratic accountability, is very inefficient, very opaque, and they feel very alienated from. And the real problem with Brexit, which has a lot of implications for the American election right now, is not just that it showed that the elite was disconnected from everyone else, and not just that it showed that voters were angry. It also showed that if you want to win an election today, you have to give people a positive vision. You need a positive slogan. And the people who wanted to stay, people who wanted to get out of Europe, basically campaigned on this slogan of take back control. It's a positive slogan with a verb, a sense of momentum. The people who wanted to stay inside Europe gave no positive vision of Europe. They just tried to scare people.
Well, let's bring it to America for a second then, because the Donald Trump slogan has been and is now make America great again, which indicates that somehow America is no longer great. And that's a difficult thing to argue, it seems to me, given that we are the superpower in the world and we pretty much run the world.
Well, I would say the thing about the Donald Trump slogan is that I went to both the RNC and DNC events as a reporter or with a team of reporters. And what struck me was you came out of the Cleveland event with the Republicans under no doubt about what the core slogan was. Make America great again. It's a slogan which is like the Brexit slogan, take back control, that has momentum, a verb, it's positive.
Okay.
I came out of the Democratic event in Philadelphia.
Stronger together.
Well, that's sort of the slogan. It's also, I'm with her, stronger together. These aren't slogans that give a very positive forward momentum. And so, yes,
but
the Democrats
But the conventions told very different stories. The Republican convention told a very dire straits in America, that we're going to hell in a handbasket, that only one man can save us from ourselves, etc. The other convention, the Democratic convention, painted this bright and rosy picture of an America on the brink of a new tomorrow, very much like Ronald Reagan's convention. And there was a lot of flag waving for the Democrats, which did not used to be the way it was done at the Democratic convention. So doesn't that story that they told supplant the slogan?
Well, many of the boundaries in America are breaking down very rapidly. And certainly the Democrats are trying very hard to present an image of positivity and a sense of, you know, cohesion and a vision. The problem, which is really going to, I think, dog Hillary Clinton in the coming months, is that I think if you ask most people what she stands for, what her policy framework is, what her core message is.
Well, more of the same.
Exactly. She's basically saying more of the same. She is a vote for the status quo. And right now, the status quo is just not very popular. And what we saw in the UK vote is that voters are really losing their fear of the unknown.
Yes.
And I think one reason is that in the last 10 years, people in the Western world have seen many of the old certainties collapse. People used to think they would never see a big bank collapse. They assumed that you could never have negative interest rates. And that's all changing. So the idea of leaping into the political unknown after seeing the financial unknown and economic unknown take hold begins to seem less impossible.
Is that smart or is that reckless? And if we're willing to jump into the unknown and the unknown turns out to be bad, like a financial collapse, or causes the markets to be very uncertain, therefore your 401k declines in value and your house declines in value or you can't sell your house, wow, isn't that reckless?
Well, it's certainly risky. But, you know, I think one of Donald Trump's most striking phrases recently is, what have you got to lose? And if you're part of the elite right now, you say, well, actually, I've got a lot to lose, and I don't want to rip up the status quo. If you are part
But isn't the other side of that question, what have you got to gain?
Well, I think many people, as we saw in the Brexit vote, would say, actually, we think we've got more potentially to gain than we've got to lose by jumping into the unknown. And what's interesting is that, you know, the short-term costs of Brexit, voting for Brexit, for many people in the UK will be quite high.
Mm-hmm.
But the areas of the UK that voted for Brexit were the ones which had the most to, lose economically.
You know, we heard a lot about, I'm going to come back to that. heard a lot during the Brexit exit about how awful it was going to be, and it traumatized Britain, and we saw the changeover in leadership at the prime minister level. And then it quieted down. We've heard nothing about this, nothing at all about this for a month.
Well, Why? That's partly because the reason everything's gone quiet is partly because the whole thing right now is in the pending box. Theresa May is not expected to start the mechanism to leave the European Union. Theresa May is the new UK Prime Minister until next year, possibly until the end of next year.
Okay.
And even after she starts a formal process of leaving European Union, it's going to take at least 2 years. So Brexit's not going to actually happen until probably 2019 at the earliest. Long delay.
In a column that you wrote on Brexit and how it might relate to the American election, you wrote, you quote two of your colleagues, Gideon Rockman and Edward Luce, who called the Brexit vote, quote, a howl of rage against economic pain, immigration, and a loss of cultural identity.
Sounds familiar.
Exactly like the Donald Trump campaign.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Like the Donald Trump
campaign. I think there are many, many parallels between what's going on right now in the U.S. and what happened with the Brexit vote to do with this sense of anger against the elite, to do with the issue of messaging, whether you can give a positive message or not, to do with people's willingness to jump into the unknown or not.
Wow. But I mean, can you blame the people that voted for Brexit? Can you blame the people who are hoping that Donald Trump becomes president? Can you blame them at all?
I'm not really in the business of blaming because I'm...
Do you understand them?
I completely understand why people are howling against the status quo. And
frankly, they right?
Are they right to feel angry? Yes, I think they are, because the reality is that the status quo elite have let down many people very badly in recent years. Are they chasing for the right solution? I think that's questionable.
Aside from the financial meltdown, how have the so-called elite, whoever they are, let them down?
I think that the financial meltdown is one example of that. I think the rising levels of income inequality.
Who's to blame for that?
The rising level of income inequality are partly a function of tax policy. It's also a function, though, of digitization, technological change, and a lack of willingness to actually address some of the core issues raised by growing digitization.
But isn't it also just capitalism? We saw yesterday the EpiPen went up from, $100 a pen to $600, and we have the discredited Martin Shkreli, who was another pharmaceutical executive who's gone down in flames because he outrageously raised the price of an HIV drug and is now under indictment, say they were right to raise the price of the EpiPen. It's capitalism. It costs them money to produce the pen. They're going to make as much money on it as they should. Well,
yes,
that's capitalism.
But then you wind it back a level and say, well, actually, the reason why they're able to do that is because of patent law and government set patent law. And the question about the degree to which you can or cannot have competition in medicine is very important.
But then
you wind it back a stage further and say, well, actually, a lot of the big medical breakthroughs that have made companies rich and brought benefits have come about not purely through private sector capitalist R&D. It's come about through things like the NIH. It's come about through government spending. We would not have the internet today were it not for the fact that the U.S. military had developed a lot of the platforms that people are benefiting today. Mm-hmm. Many people in America today who have seen their families rise dramatically in terms of earnings and go from, you know, working class to middle class, whatever, did so on the back of things like the GI Bill after World War II that educated an entire generation and created incredible social mobility.
So when you say that you should look where the action isn't as opposed to where the action is that where you would come to a better understanding of what's fueling this populism?
Absolutely. And just to give a small idea, I mean, one of the key elements of anthropology which I was trained in is that you have to not just look at what people say, but what they don't say. And what people don't talk about is often even more important than what they do talk about. And right now, the fact that most of the candidates are not talking about this new digital economy, the Uberization of the economy, and what it's going to mean for people's working conditions and their jobs, and how are people going to be, you know, paying for healthcare, getting educated in the years to come.
What could they say about it?
Well, I'll give you a small tangible example. Most healthcare plans today are set up with the assumption that people are either working for a big company or they're entirely freelance. Mm-hmm. What about that middle ground of people like Uber drivers who are kind of neither one nor the other? What are we going to do in a world where people are essentially working like digital sharecroppers? Is it possible to develop some kind of system of income smoothing, employment insurance for them?
Aren't they at risk of going away, these Uber? I know when you say Uber economy, you're talking about more than just the drivers of these cars, but Uber is now putting cars on the street that don't have drivers. They're automatic. I mean, they're robot cars. Aren't all of these jobs just going to disappear?
Over time, jobs are going to disappear. And the question today, the single biggest question for the American economy today is, will this be a replay of the agricultural revolution? Because if you dial back 150 years ago, a very large part of the American workforce was working on the land. Mm-hmm. And then came along the Industrial Revolution, and people moved to cities, and those jobs were displaced, but new jobs were created in factories. The question is, what do you do in that interim period when one lot of jobs are lost and you're waiting for the next big thing to create new jobs? How do you smooth that over?
Right.
In the early years of the 20th century, the Industrial Revolution, the industrialization, gave birth to things like the welfare state, to unions. That was a social policy response. The big question now is, as we move from the Industrial Revolution to the Technology Revolution to cyberspace, if you like, is it time to start thinking about new types of social contracts, new types of government policies, new types of educating people?
This is all very scary. It's all very speculative. Nobody really knows what's going to happen. It's like this whole conversion of the music industry. Nobody knew what was going to happen, that it was going to collapse the way it has. So how do leaders know what to say, and how do you know whom to follow?
Well, that's a very good question, because the nature of trust has changed dramatically in the last couple of decades. There's a group called Edelman who do a very interesting survey which shows who people do or don't trust in 18 countries. And this shows that over the last decade, unsurprisingly, trust in many big institutions like, you know, banks, business, government, and the media has declined very dramatically. But the most interesting thing is, if you ask people where do they get their information from that they trust, it used to be that people trusted CEOs, civic leaders, politicians. Today, they're more likely to trust a category known as a person like me, your peer group. And so we're going from a world where people looked to people in authority for information and that they could trust, to one where people basically trust their Facebook friends.
Yes, and isn't that dangerous?
It's dangerous because you create potentially tribalism, tunnel vision. You have this tremendous sense that everybody can have their own truth, their own little kind of, you know, post-truthy world where everyone defines the world as they want in this customized way.
Wow. So many more questions, but so little time. None, actually. Jillian Tett, our guest, U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times. Thanks for the hour.